Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Oh, Hannah, I did it right. I did it right tonight.
You scored.
What do we got?
We have a Dark Phoenix beer. It's a IPA from...
Looks like Boulevard from Kansas City, Missouri. And they did a special movie tie-in with X-Men Dark Phoenix, the latest Dark X-Men installment, and it's an IPA, and I saw it on the shelf, and I'm like, oh, we gotta do this. It's specifically called Space Invader, I think.
Oh.
No, it's not. Space Camper. Space Camper.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, no, you're spot on with the beverage this evening.
Yeah.
Congrats.
You're what? Yeah, this
and
is
it's
a
actually
rare.
A pretty decent beer.
Kind of looks like Jean Grey on the can, too.
A little bit.
Let's start off with this week's, actually not... biggest film, because I think the biggest film this week will be the sequel, The Secret Life of Pets 2, which we regretfully did not go see.
Yes, it was tempting, but we had so much else to see, at least I did, and I was not a huge fan of the first one, and frankly, it doesn't matter what we would have to say about it, because it's going to do extremely well, because I know a bunch of kids that are just chomping at the bit to see Secret Life of Pets 2.
Yeah, I'm with you. I did not take to the first one, but I have a hunch I'll probably end up actually seeing this tomorrow.
As well you should.
With my kid. But it's not the only sequel out this week. X-Men. This is the 12th X-Men, and I do forgive everybody in advance if they have no idea where we are in the
That's
franchise.
Right. I'm like, it's not really a sequel, because... those 12 movies, I think, even include Deadpool.
And most of them are moot, because time travel happened and wiped out most of them.
The whole timeline of the X-Men has always befuddled me quite a bit.
But we've seen a variation of Dark Phoenix before. It's a very famous arc in the comic book with Jean Grey as the central figure. Jean Grey's power is very similar to Professor X's, Professor Charles Xavier's. She's a cerebral one. She's telekinetic, and she can also read people's minds and their thoughts and move things out there. She's one of the more powerful X-Men, and we've seen this before in X2, the second one from 2003. She did not have a very good end in that film. I think she was played by Famke Janssen.
I did not remember X2 at all.
I remember it.
So this character was not one that ever had really resonated with me, which is why I think it was a little more difficult to really feel what I felt like I should be feeling for what is, you know, potentially the end of the franchise, as Fox has put it out there, because of changing hands and the ownership will go to Disney, and they might reboot it and do some new stuff. Yeah, they will eventually, because it's a superhero movie. But I never felt the same way about the X-Men as I did about the Avengers. So to me, Dark Phoenix turned into a bit of a Endgame light.
I met the X-Men before I met the Avengers, so I do really have a soft spot for them. They hit it big when I was 12 years old or so. And I was 12 in 1992, which is when this takes place. And this is an alternate history, an alternate version of the 1992. They're not, mutants in this world are not feared. They're not at war with regular humans. They're actually beloved. They are superheroes. The X-Men team goes out and saves humans. So there's peace on Earth and goodwill toward mutants. In the beginning, the space shuttle Endeavor is blasting off into space. They run into a problem when they hit this atomic gaseous cloud of something. And so the X-Men against Raven, played by Jennifer Lawrence's better judgment, Professor X orders them into space to save the astronauts, and they mostly do, except Jean Grey runs into a problem. To save the last guy, she has to sacrifice herself a little bit, and she ends up inhaling this atomic gaseous cloud and bringing it back down with her to Earth, which causes problems. Not only does it unleash deliberately sealed memories from her childhood that she's been cut off from, which starts tearing her apart from the inside, it also exacerbates schisms, which were inherent in the X-Men team, specifically between Raven and Professor X, and Raven's boyfriend, Dr. Hank McCoy, and other team members, and it brings Magneto into the fold. So the X-Men team starts fighting amongst themselves. That's a more reliable and familiar storyline.
A little Avengers Civil War going on there.
Absolutely. So all in all, take this as a whole. This is lackluster. This is bottom of the barrel X-Men. I was not excited. I was not engaged. I was not intrigued. I don't find Jean Grey a very interesting character. Nobody has anything to do. Even the action was a little bit ho-hum. Blech.
Yeah, even though, and I won't spoil it, but a major character is killed off. And so you should be feeling a whole lot more.
That major character was just here cashing a paycheck.
Yeah. And it just was, I think this has like a 23% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's just harsh.
That high?
I think that that's kind of unfair because this is not the worst of the X-Men movies. So there have been
far better. No, it's better than X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Yeah, so, and I mean, I loved Hugh Jackman as Wolverine.
But some of those Wolverine spinoffs.
Some of them were pretty bad. I always loved James McAvoy and Patrick Stewart combined playing Professor X, Charles Xavier. There are elements that I've always liked about the X-Men, but they've always been a bit hit or miss, and this one is not the worst of the bunch. So I think it falls somewhere in like the lower third, but not at the bottom.
Jean Grey's always been very melodramatic. She's never had a normal. She doesn't have normal powers, but she's always overplayed her hand. Like, oh, I don't belong here. Where do I belong? No one understands me. And it always falls into that paradigm. So she runs away, and so half the mutants are, let's save her. I still believe in her. She's still in there. And the other half is, she did something really bad, and I'm going to kill her. She's not the only pseudo-villain in the story. There is another paper-thin, no-backstory villain played by Jessica Chastain. Yeah. She's an alien. I don't know where from, and I don't even know what her alien race is called. They come and they can shapeshift into humans as their disguise, because they don't look like humans. And they want to take over the power that is within Jean Grey to, I guess, take over the Earth and wipe out some humans. You know, you've seen this before. Agent Smith in the Matrix trilogy, humans are a disease, you are a cancer. We just saw it with Thanos. Thanos was doing the same thing. And so now, whatever her, I don't even know if her name was said, but Jessica Chastain, the villain, is ridiculous.
Yeah, it was a very, very, very weak subplot with her. I never understood who she was supposed to be and why, what their motivations were at all for just sort of coming down and just suddenly trying to kill a bunch of people. And they always are like, oh, the weak spot that's always exploited is that they care too much about the humans, and that's their Achilles heel, is that the bad people from outer space can come down and all they have to do is threaten the humans a bit, and the X-Men are going to fight on their behalf, and so that's treated as some sort of weakness, which of course is also their greatest strength. So it was there's so much about this that was that felt like elements and retreads from things that we had seen before. But I still think that if you are an X-Men fan,
and you'd be disappointed if you're an X-Men fan.
But I think you're still going to see it because it is the conclusion to some degree of this series of films. And you don't want to not see it. If you've committed to the previous 11, you're
going to
see
this. A lot of people are actually not going to see this. This is going to lose 20th Century Fox a lot of money.
Yeah, but I still think, to me, it's, wait and you can watch it, down the line and rent it. But at some point, I do think if you want to put a final stamp on this entire series of films.
Yes, if you want to leave yourself with a sour aftertaste, of course you have to watch Dark Phoenix.
But if you don't, you're left just sort of hanging with with some of the previous
films. Are you really hanging? Like, they don't wrap up anything.
Yeah, they do.
Jean Grey doesn't have a problem before this film.
But they treat it... I think they are going for that... They're attempting to do that sort of endgame wrap-up with where you're dealing with the very first of the first class of X-Men and trying to wrap up their story. And so that, to me, is really the only thing that I got out of it, was just sort of reflecting back on what I think was one of the better of those movies, which was the was First Class.
Well, actually, I much prefer Days of Future Past.
Days of Future Past is right up there. So those are my two favorites. So I would say that that those two are the strongest of the bunch in my book. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't terrible to watch. It just was sort of meh, disappointing.
My biggest problem, every time I watch any of these 12, and it comes up every time, and I wonder if you noticed this, is the difference in powers between the mutants, especially when they fight. One of the most powerful, if not the most powerful mutant, should be Storm. She can shoot lightning bolts from her palms and summon the wrath of tornadoes and hurricanes. Yet she has trouble fighting the guy with dreadlocks, who can whip him around really fast and kind of crack you one in the face.
Her character was the weakest, I thought. She was really
given.
She was really powerful. But she was given next to nothing.
No, she never. When Halle Berry was Storm, yeah, she also had nothing to do. Yeah. Storm has never had anything to do. And I wonder if that's because writers realized, wow, she really is really powerful, but she can't fight the guy with dreadlocks, whipping him around, and it's so weak.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, this movie just made me want to see Endgame again, just to be reminded of how a good finale is done, because I think that one really did set a very high bar, and this one just couldn't even come anywhere close.
Well, our next two films are actually kind of tied together genre-wise. They are both music documentaries, and you saw the first one, and by far the bigger one. It's getting a lot more screens, and it has a much more notable director with a long, long filmography. And can you tell me, can you explain why Luciano Pavarotti had a film made about him by Mr. Ron Howard?
Because Ron Howard loves good stories and good bigger-than-life characters. And he recognized in Pavarotti, who I think he had met once before at some Happy Days event or something, that this guy was infectious. Like, he just was lit up a room and just enjoyed people, and people enjoyed being around him. And he was opera's ambassador to the world. And so I think Ron Howard had the same thinking that a lot of other people would, is you don't need to be an opera buff to appreciate Pavarotti and what he brought to the table, which was an accessibility factor. He was in commercials. I remember him in like a shower-to-shower commercial and an American Express commercial. And aside from the opera, the opera purists who will know him from his roles in La Boheme and other big opera productions, a lot of people who are not huge opera fans will know him because of his bringing this group of people together for charity events called Pavarotti and Friends. And that included people like Mariah Carey and Bono. And Bono's featured in this film. He loved Pavarotti. And also, Pavarotti got together in the 90s with these other two tenors, with Placido Domingo and Jose Carreras, and they were together the three tenors. And they also, as a unit, brought some opera joy to the masses. And so Ron Howard was looking at that. And I saw an interview, and he said, Ron Howard was saying how he didn't really know much about the space program before Apollo 13 that he did. And he didn't know all that much about Formula One racing when he did the excellent film Rush, which was a really great film that a lot of people have not seen, with
Niki Lauda. Hemsworth.
Yeah. And so he was saying, you don't need this. By the same way, you might gain an appreciation for opera through understanding and knowing about Luciano Pavarotti, who... This story, definitely makes you aware that he had issues. And I remember in his later in life, here was this guy who was from Italy, was from a Catholic country, a good old Catholic boy who had a family. And then ended up obviously womanizing, having all these affairs, ended up at near the end of his life marrying this very young woman and having a child with her.
Signore.
Yeah. But so his, you know, his credibility factor kind of on a personal level kind of took a major hit towards the end of his life. But this film shows his journey from this town in Italy and, you know, to learn about his background and then to be reminded of his musical talent and his personality. He was on all the late night shows, the morning shows. He did cooking segments. So he was just always out there and just always seemed like a really fun guy. And he had this insanely incredible voice.
So did Ron Howard figure him out?
Ron Howard isn't figuring him out so much as letting you in.
Or is it just chronological?
It's not totally chronological, but some of it does not track very well, especially where his personal relationships are concerned. But it is reminding people of who he was and what he brought to the world of opera and how... And this movie just soars when there is the singing.
Does it have weight or is it fluff?
No, it has some weight, and it's not a fluffy documentary. I mean, the thing, it is really, it's the music. It's the music that draws you in and keeps you in. And Ron Howard knows how to make a good movie. So even though there might be some things that are kind of missing narratively, he knows how to keep the pace going, and he knows how to let those moments that are really good breathe.
Is it a celebration?
It's a celebration, but also this guy had his flaws, and we're not going to discount those, but he brought something to the world and here's why, and here's what you might not have known about his family life and his upbringing and his motivations and his relationship. Like, he shifted after meeting Princess Diana, they became friends, and she's the one who really encouraged him to find happiness in charity work, and that's when he really started launching all these opportunities to help. It was the Children of Bosnia, the fundraisers that he did. I remember them very well. I bought some of the CDs that were, where some of the proceeds went to charity. And I love those reminders. And when you see why Bono loved him and...
But as a film, as a documentary, is it worth it?
Yes. And it's worth it for both the... opera lovers, because you do hear
all two of you.
You no, there's I think there, anybody who, you know, like my parents who listen to Live from the Metropolitan Opera every Saturday afternoon, that's who it's for. But it's also for my generation who did actually see Pavarotti on Sesame Street and with the Muppets and doing all these other things, but then really appreciating his duets with pop music stars and what he brought, the fun that you see him have as part of the three tenors is really infectious. And they're kind of these three amazing tenors competing with each other, but having a really fun time doing it. I think it brings a opera appreciation and a music appreciation to a lot of people who might not otherwise really know who Pavarotti was and what his backstory was. So it does bring a lot of his backstory to light. And so he does the best that I think anyone could possibly have done with the material, and it lets the music speak or sing for itself, which is really what drives this film, which is amazing stuff.
Well, it sounds like it's night and day from our second musical documentary called Echo in the Canyon, which is not about one person, it's about many people, but more... importantly, it's about a specific place in a very, very specific time. Canyon means Laurel Canyon, Los Angeles, and the specific time is that mid-60s, 65, 66, 67, when these folk artists somehow all congregated in Los Angeles and morphed, transitioned this traditional folk music into more rock and roll tunes. You have David Crosby saying he was the first. You have other people saying it was the Beach Boys and the Birds first. You don't really know who's first. But yeah, so you have Crosby, you have Stephen Stills, Tom Petty, Jacob Dylan.
Mamas and the Papas.
Jacob Dylan, Bob Dylan's son, if you remember him from the Wallflowers, is driving around town in his vintage car. And he's interviewing Michelle Phillips, and he's hanging out with Beck and Regina Spektor and Cat Power, and they're reminiscing about it. They weren't even there yet, but they're reminiscing about what they think this time and place must have been like when people were experimenting with this radical maneuver of music that some people did not appreciate, them bastardizing this folk music. I want to launch some questions at you since you...
Well, first, I think you should tell them what the title of this movie is.
I did. I said Echo in the Canyon, where Canyon is Laurel Canyon. I want to launch some questions at you.
We'll go back and rewind.
The film starts with Tom Petty, mm-hmm. and this, I believe it's in there because they say this is Tom Petty's final interview before he passed away. Tom Petty was too young to participate in the Laurel Canyon scene. He's the next generation. He didn't really come around until the 70s. These are 60s people. Is the Tom Petty business only in here because he died?
No, I think a big part of this film that you maybe missed was even the beginning when they explain the definition of echo, and it's about the influence that this core group who all congregated in Laurel Canyon, and it's not so much about who started what, it's about the collaboration that they kind of kept each other going and creating this music and the creative process. And that is really what part of why they talk to different people. It's about just how this music resonated and survived and was sort of the mantle was taken up by folks like Tom Petty. And so the same where I think they had the concert where they had contemporary artists do a lot of these songs.
Yeah, they had Fiona Apple up there doing mm-hmm. their versions of, you know, the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
Yeah, Nora Jones. I mean, these are really good contemporary artists.
But they really bookended the film with Tom Petty, and I think they did that.
It might have been a little gratuitous because they had that interview, and knowing that you've got what was the final interview with somebody, that what else are you necessarily going to do with it when you got that interview to be a part of this documentary that you are putting together? And so whether or not they overextended their use of him, that's possible. But just like the Pavarotti film, what makes this documentary really enjoyable is not so much the talking head stuff, but the performances. And they let a lot of those performances breathe. And these songs really were poetry set to music.
The musical sections are spectacular. Mm-hmm. However, so they dug up, didn't dig her up, but you know, she comes up every now. Michelle Phillips, the last surviving member of the Mamas and the Papas. When you think folk in California dreaming in Los Angeles, that's who you think of. She tells this story of cheating on John Phillips with Denny Doherty. Everybody already knows that. You know why? Because we all saw VH1's Behind the Music. She tells the same story I saw on VH1. She's killing it. Like, give me something new here.
Yeah, I mean, those moments were less, you know, they were not revelatory moments. I enjoyed learning just more about how Laurel Canyon was this scene, you know, back in the 60s. And there's even a mention in Rocket Man of going to a party at Mama Cass's house in LA. And they talked about how they would all gather, you know, they would gather at these parties that Mama Cass had and that others of this folk rock generation had in their collaborations. And so I was not aware for all the times when I lived in LA and drove across Laurel Canyon. It's a great little hamlet. It's, you just know that it's like you're near LA, but you're somehow removed from the surreality of LA. And you had this little artsy enclave, which I think is kind of cool. And I think it's still trying to be cool. Laurel Canyon people are still trying to preserve that artistic cool factor. But when you see something like this documentary, it really just makes you appreciate that just what they all, their little community that they had, and the music that they were able to make. And this was good music. And so anybody who really loves folk music, folk rock music, who was into the Byrds and the Mamas and the Papas, this is going to just be a very entertaining, lightweight film.
Lightweight, yes. This is an addition to this growing subgenre of music documentary. In the last couple of years, we had The Wrecking Crew, which was about the backing musicians who are on every single one of these songs that we're talking about, and Muscle Shoals, you know, the Swampers down there in the Southeast that were all the East Coast versions of the backing band. And I think Echo in the Canyon is actually lesser than all of these. It's fluffier, it's lighter, it's more meandering. You got Jacob Dylan sitting with Beck and like there's looking at LPs on someone's coffee table, which goes nowhere. The contemporary concert is okay. I really liked the vintage stuff they dug up of these concerts I actually had never seen before. Very young Neil Young, good Lord. And you got kind of people that they're fuzzy, like this guy was first, that guy was second. Lou Adler shows up. He's less famous now than he was. I think Clapton showed up. You got some really good interviews in here, but it's less than its peers.
It depends on what genre you happen to really like. And some friends of mine saw it in LA a couple weeks ago and really loved it. And I think the people who love seeing these things, if there is any opportunity for sort of that Q&A and discussion with other people who are into music, that's the kind of thing this is. This is for, you know, sitting outside. I think it would be just one of those, a great film for just screening in the summer in an outdoor venue and just having a few beers sitting on the lawn and listening and watching this documentary. To me, that's the vibe that makes it really work. Not necessarily sitting in a regular theater. Do you need to rush out to a regular theater without anything surrounding the presentation? Probably not. You know, Pavarotti is a well-produced, it's directed by Ron Howard, so you're going to get a much cleaner, better paced film. With this one, though, just like with Pavarotti, you just have music that's infectious and fun. There's another one coming out next week, I think. Woodstock, 3 days that shaped a generation. So who knows? I have a feeling.
Pretty sure Woodstock's been covered.
Yeah. So I don't know how many more of these they can kind of keep plowing, you know,
I don't think they're going to finish anytime
soon. But there are a lot more music documentaries coming down the pike. And so for music buffs, I think they're perfectly entertaining, you know, if you miss the whole behind the music kind of show.
I'm still going to, as they come out, I'm still going to rack and stack them. And this one just comes in lower than the rest.
It depends. I was never into Muscle Shoals. Like, that one didn't really appeal to me.
That one was awesome. That blew my mind.
But again, it just depends on what kind of music you like.
No, and I actually prefer the folk stuff on the West Coast than I do, like, the Lynyrd Skynyrd business and the Allman Brothers. Like, I actually don't jive with that, but that was just a good documentary.
Yeah, but again, they're solid documentaries for music fans.
So I love the fact that this week you saw the French film.
You were supposed to see the French film.
You saw the French film.
I can't believe you did not see this
Tell me about the French film.
Well, the French film, which ironically is called the Fall of the American Empire.
How French does that sound?
But it's actually Canadian.
Oh.
But it's in French. And I'm watching this thing going, oh my God, this is a Charlie movie. This is a Charlie movie. This is a Charlie movie. Why am I watching this? Because this is a Charlie movie. The guy is like this pretend. The first 5 minutes, you've got this guy who's like totally pretentious.
Oh, I love this guy already.
And he's breaking, you know, this girl's breaking up with him because he just thinks everybody but him is an idiot.
Oh, I love this guy.
I know. And
reminds me of my Homer Simpson gif I sent last week.
It was just so you at the beginning. But so I went in totally blind except for a single line synopsis. And I got the link because I was convinced that you were going to see this one because it had your name written all over it. But so you have this sort of insecure intellectual type guy with a PhD in philosophy, but he works as a package courier because to actually pay the bills. As philosophy
majors do.
Exactly, to pay the bills. And so one day while he's making this delivery, he gets caught up in this robbery gone bad. And basically they've all killed each other, the robbers and the bad guys who come upon the robbers. And so basically all these people end up getting shot. These two giant bags of money are kind of left on the street outside of where the robbery took place. And the courier is there making his delivery. And one guy is injured and runs off and drops one big bag. And so the whole thing is then about, do you take this money? Do you take the money and run? Like the moral dilemma that this guy is
scenario
facing.
Sounds like the final paper of an undergrad philosophy class.
So the thing is, he takes the money. He takes the money.
Well, it wouldn't be a movie if he didn't.
But then that triggers, it plays out like a very witty film noir heist movie. And the guy ends up kind of engaging the services of the high-priced escort that he ends up falling in love with.
As one does.
Yes. And who you never quite know. It's like, is she playing him because she knows he's got this money? Or is she really falling for him? Or what's going to happen there? But then he also is smart enough to know that he needs to figure out who can help him launder this money and unload this money and spend this money without these two cops that are on his tail sort of busting him. And so he befriends this guy who is just fresh out of jail, who was a basically a con man, but brilliant financial dude. And so the three of them then sort of together end up trying to figure out how this brilliant sort of scheme to try and launder this money. And it's talking about it's really interesting because it's really a social satire film. And the guy has a soft spot for the homeless. He works with the homeless, and he wants to really help them with some of this money. And so some of it is, how can he use this money to help other people without getting caught? Because basically it's dirty money to begin with. And so there's no real victim if he does sort of try and keep the money, except
that's
that,
a philosopher trying to rationalize his ill-gotten gains.
But the social satire part of it, where it's really exposing the criminal element, but the just does money really make people happy? And it's just a very interesting. It totally grew on me, and you're rooting for this trio to somehow manage to get away with it. And the film actually ends, it really is a very satisfying ending. And so I think you would have really enjoyed it. And I was shocked that you did not go and watch it, because I think it would have been your favorite film of the week.
You're probably right. Let's peek ahead to next week. The one next week is crowded. Lord, it's crowded.
I know, it's ridiculous.
And naturally, the one I am most seething and frothing at the mouth to see is the new Jim Jarmusch film, The Dead Don't Die, which premiered at Cannes. I love Jim Jarmusch. We're talking Ghost Dog, we're talking Broken Flowers, and we're talking zombies with Bill Murray and Adam Driver.
I know, if it wasn't Bill Murray and Adam Driver, I would absolutely be skipping that one, but I do like Adam Driver, I do like Bill Murray, and it's just weird enough looking to sort of pique my interest
it's
a little bit.
It's going to be weird, I'm telling you.
It's going to be very weird. And so we had to choose between that one and Shaft.
Yeah,
I'd rather
see
we're
that.
Giving Shaft the Shaft next week.
Well, I didn't see Shaft the first time Samuel
L. Jackson
did it.
I don't think
Jackson
I did either, I know. And so since I don't recall really, I know that it's got a lot of loving fans out there, and so I'm sure they'll enjoy it for whatever it might be. But then we'll talk about Late Night, which you do have another opportunity to go see.
I can't, because otherwise I would not see Men in Black International. Talk about a film I'm dreading. The first Men in Black was fun. It was fun. I was a senior in high school when that came out. And then the next two were garbage. So, of course, they're rebooting it in... Ugh, it looks
so
bad.
Oh, I don't know. It's with Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson, and they had a fun little dynamic going in the Thor movie.
It could still be not good.
And I mean, there's a lot. I mean, to have to compete to have Men in Black International Late Night, which is the workplace comedy.
I already Mindy heard Kaling, Late Night's going to lose. No Emma one's going Thompson. To see that.
Well, and just like nobody saw Booksmart. And the thing is that I think Booksmart was actually better, but we'll talk about that next
Booksmart
week.
Booksmart was outstanding, but no, unfortunately, but Late Night's going to die.
I don't know. It would take, yeah, it's no, got too know. Much. It's got too much competing with it. They moved the release from this week to next week, which I think might have been even more of a mistake. Because I think it's going to get buried, including the I don't know how well The Dead Don't Die will do. But I've also, another one that we missed that we don't have a chance to see is The Last Black Man in San Francisco. And I've actually heard very good things about that one.
Yeah,
so,
that does sound really good.
Yeah, so it's one of those things.
Jim Jarmusch has a cult following.
Yeah.
And he actually doesn't really make movies to make money. He makes movies to make movies. And people love him. He has diehard fans. Mindy Kaling has fans, but not diehard cult fans.
But they're TV fans, so it depends on how much of the TV audience, like The Office.
No, Late Night will probably make even more money than The Dead Don't Die, but budget comparisons, it's gonna die.
It's going to be the only comedy choice. I mean, unless you're a zombie fan.
Yeah. Zombie. Oh, no. What do you think? Men in Black International is a comedy.
Oh, yeah. I guess Men in Black will be a comedy, too. Yeah. I don't know. It's going to be a very interesting.
It's just a busy week.
It's just busy. And then there's going to be a lull. It looks like really through July, like one big release a week.
Fair enough.
And so maybe we'll plan our summer vacations.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I got a kindergarten graduate time. Taken out for a week, so we'll skip the week after
there
that.
There you go.
All right, well, quick recap. Dark Phoenix, even though we bought the beer to go along with it, is not a good X-Men film. The franchise ends with a whimper.
It does end with a whimper, which is kind of sad.
Pavarotti,
it's fun if you remember Pavarotti and Friends and the Three Tenors, or you just were a huge Pavarotti fan from his days actually doing opera.
Echo in the Canyon has good tunes, but you've heard it all before, including all the juicy gossip.
But it reminds you what good songwriting used to be. And so I did love it for just hearing some of those really good mid to late 60s folk rock music tunes. And so there's a fan base for that. That's who this movie is for.
And The Fall of the American Empire
is the movie that, Charlie, you should have seen. And I would say you don't have to run out to a theater and see it, but if it pops up on some streaming service and you think it rings a bell and you just like a heist movie that has some very philosophical undertones, some wit. I mean, there were moments where you just sort of found yourself laughing. So I think The Fall of the American Empire is one to just kind of note for a future watch at home on Netflix or something.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time to listen to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.